I used to walk around and say, I don't judge anyone except Christians.
I remember a magistrate saying, you're not listening to anything we're trying to do, you're going to prison, son.
People are mysteries and also infinitely valuable in that way.
Then they tell you you'll probably be dead within 27 months.
Tim Winton is one of Australia's favourite writers. A master storyteller, his latest novel, The Shepherd's Hut, continues the Winton tradition of delving into and celebrating the lives of the outcasts, those on the fringes of respectable society, the people with bad teeth. This story focuses on the life of a neglected and abused and angry teenage boy who, in running away from a disaster in his life, finds himself in the unforgiving Australian wilderness where he strikes up an unlikely and somewhat awkward friendship. The novel is a huge achievement. Tim Winton came into CPX to talk about the novel and also about toxic masculinity, a subject he has a lot to say about. Tim Winton, so great to have you in. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the new book. It's another wonderful contribution from you, another wonderful offering. Now, in this Shepherd's Hut book, there's this young, neglected, troubled boy, Jaxie Clacton, who kind of at the beginning prays for the death of his father, but it's a case of be careful what you wish for, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Jaxie's had a pretty tough go. You know, he's from this northern wheat belt sort of tiny town, kind of desolate sort of place. It's just his mum and his dad. His mum's just recently died of cancer. The boys watched his mum being humiliated and beaten, and she's just sort of, in the end, had the good fortune to get cancer and die and get out of the marriage, really. But yeah, Jaxie's, you know, wounded, scarred, he's beaten by his father, he's just had no nurture, you know. And yeah, he does, you know, when we first meet him, he's hiding under the grandstand at the local footy ground just after having had a hiding, and, you know, one eye's swollen shut, and he's wishing his father would die. And then he goes home when he thinks it's safe, when the old man's safely drunk enough and comatose, to find out that the old man is dead. He goes out in the shed and finds him under the car that's fallen off the jack, and that's a pretty grisly opening sequence.
Violent end.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Violent life.
Anyway, he Jaxie thinks, man, I'm gonna cop it, because everyone's gonna think I did it, because everyone knows what the old man's done to me. No one's ever defended the kid, of course. No one's ever. No one's ever looked out for his interests, but he just thinks I've got to leave. So he racks off. He grabs a high powered rifle out of the gun safe, and he grabs a backpack and a bit of food and a jug of water, and he hoofs it. He just heads off out into the bush and basically walks out into the gold fields and then into the salt country, you know, before the great deserts of the interior. Running away from his life, I suppose, but also running to the prospect of something better.
Yeah, and the prospect is sort of the one person, isn't it, in his life who he can connect with, his girlfriend.
Yeah, who awkwardly happens to be his cousin, but
yes,
I'll get that out of the way. there's just this one person who represents love and affection and kindness and sympathy and interest, you know, and they, you know, at least in Jaxie's mind, they have a, you know, a real relationship, which is about mutual interest and kindness. And so, yeah, he's going to do whatever he can, walking by foot across the desert, or at least across the Badlands, to get to her. So in an odd way, it's like at one level, it's a sort of an adventure story, but it's also sort of a quest, I suppose.
It must have been, really early on, as you're writing in first person, must be an incredible challenge to, as a writer and someone who's used to language, to put a whole novel in the voice of a character like that, who's an uneducated, kind of neglected boy. That's a massive technical challenge.
Yeah, that's true. It does present you a few
because you're limited, right, by his language.
Yeah, you've only got this really narrow lexicon. I mean, you know, he's got a very narrow emotional range. I'm stuck with this kid's very narrow vocabulary, and yet I'm trying to get him into a space where he's thinking about big things, ultimate things. And yeah, it's hard. It's hard going. And if you love language as much as me, it's quite difficult to immerse yourself for, you know, all day, all week, all year, and all the next year in that impoverishment, you know, cultural, linguistic, spiritual impoverishment. But it was an interesting challenge to try to make beauty out of squalor. I mean, that's part of art, really. It's part of the great mystery of art, is that most art comes from suffering and most art comes from squalor. Not the squalor and the suffering of the artist so much as about, you know, human suffering and human squalor and aspiration.
You often have these sort of barely articulate characters, certainly emotionally stunted, and yet you have a real sympathy for them in the sense that you convey the fact that there's more going on for them than might meet the eye.
Yeah, well, that's just the fruit of my experience as a human, and I've learned over the years that you meet people and you make assumptions about them by what they're wearing, what they look like, what their accent's like, what their teeth are like, because dentition seems to be, you know, a pretty big predictor of what someone's life is like and where they are on the social ladder. But yeah, my experience has been that there's always more going on than you realise, and so you have to. It's a bit like landscape and nature. You make assumptions about it. On the surface, it looks like one thing, but that's the ignorant view. Once you get inside and once you look long enough, there's a great deal going on that you need to attend to and learn. So yeah, I am interested in people like that, and I'm interested in ways of giving them a voice. Because there are a lot of young people who are missing out in our country, and they're missing out culturally, they're missing out in terms of, you know, disadvantages of geography, of class, of gender, and also just generationally. You know, they're not the luckiest generation to have been born on this continent.
No, I think you would suggest that there's a real lack for a lot of young people, especially young men, in terms of good role models, father figures, if not their own fathers.
Yeah, I think, you know, given that we are one of the most prosperous nations on earth, it troubles me that culturally we would be producing this level of impoverishment, you know. And I think that the kind of rituals of young Australians, and particularly young men, the sort of rites of passage by which they find their way from infancy into, you know, boyhood and then into manhood, you know, those rites are so impoverished, so nasty. And that level of poverty, you know, doesn't promise, doesn't bode well for the future. I think in that sense, you know, we're sowing salt into the earth for the future.
I attended a high school. There was a government boarding school, boys' boarding school, and it was. It always struck me as somewhere as a great potential for. You had this sort of environment where you could have developed had you had the right leadership. So real respect for people and interest in and indifference and, you know, a huge amount of good spirit among them. Instead, you got anti-intellectualism, racism, sexism, you know, brutality, actually.
Yeah.
And it's often made me, as an adult, quite angry, because I thought, I've seen a difference, too. I've seen a different way you can do that in a boys' school when I was a teacher in another school in Sydney, where, in fact, you saw a celebration of people who had different interests and skills and different versions of what being a male was. And, you know, it wasn't perfect, but you had people who could express themselves in different ways and that be celebrated. I always thought, wow, that's what we want for people, not this other thing. And I still get a bit angry about it.
Yeah, because there's this sort of assumption about it that it's all determined, that that this is necessary, or it's something you have to resign yourself to. And you're only at the mercy of, as you say, the leadership and the culture, whether that's of the school or of the family or of the suburb or of you know, the state, the town. All these cultures are deeply important, and they have a huge influence. And we have the means to produce better cultures. We have the means to produce better modelling. We're just lazy.
Yeah.
And that laziness is destructive, and it's dangerous. And it's, as I said, you know, it's sowing salt.
If nothing else, it's a massive missed opportunity for great
things. Yeah, I mean,
it's
tragic. You know, when the country, when we as a people, when we as families, when we as schools, teams, organisations, churches, you name it, have the means to just do much more beautiful, richer, more nourishing things, and we just fall back because we're either just lazy, or we're intimidated, or we're just closed-minded.
Now, the priest in your story, Fintan McGillis, is a notable exception when it comes to language, and this is a language that kind of irritates but also fascinates Jaxi. At one point I thought this story could be called The Education of Jaxi Clacton almost. He really gets drawn into this relationship.
Yeah, in a way it's like a sentimental education. Fintan McGillis is a spoiled priest, I suppose is a kind way of putting it. Mm. He's in exile. He's been marooned out in the Salt Lakes by the church authorities for having done something or being complicit in something, and also knowing too much, and they're hiding him essentially.
Yeah.
We never find out what that is, but he's very different to Jaxi. I mean, he comes from a different hemisphere, different culture, which is a much more verbal culture, much more musical culture. Mm-hmm. Plus, he has the traditions of the church, which is not in Irish Catholicism is not the actual pinnacle of intellectual Catholicism, but it has some abstractions to it.
There's some richness there.
Yeah, and he brings that to the picture, and they are, you know, this spiky, profane, opinionated, uneducated, verbally challenged boy, you know, meets this loquacious, musical, slightly mischievous, and slightly untrustworthy Irish priest, and they're at each other, but they're dancing around each other, they're trying to figure each other out, and they, as happens in real life, they're teaching each other, they're educating each other, they're unconsciously nurturing one another. And they're stuck out there together. They realise that they need one another to stay alive, and not just physically, but, you know, the companionship, just someone to talk to.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. In Tim Winton's latest novel, The Shepherd's Heart, the character Jaxi Clacton says of his violent, horrible father, "Look, I'm not making excuses, but maybe he knew what a piece of shit he was. Could be he was embarrassed of himself sometimes. I know he was frightened." And I was just struck by that, and I thought, this is, I think, your attempt to show that sometimes the ugly behaviour of men is partly, maybe self-loathing, right?
Oh, I think that's true. I don't think it accounts for all of it, obviously. But Jaxi also says somewhere in the book that maybe the old man started out decent, but he just spoiled like meat, you know, because he's a butcher and Jaxi's a butcher's apprentice. So meat is where he goes to, meat and blood. And I think he's not very big on forgiveness, the old Jaxi, but he is trying to somehow scientifically account for just how bad the bad people in his life are, and he's trying to, you know, come up with an idea: are people just born bad, or do they learn how to be bad?
Yeah, there was a bit of East of Eden there at one point. I felt like this sort of fear that he might himself have this sort of strain that he can't resist.
And I think people from violent families often experience that. You feel that you've been infected. That violence is in you, because you know that if you've suffered violence, you get physically affected by it as well as mentally affected, and trauma does change you, and it changes your brain, and it enters, you know, traumatic experiences enter your DNA, and that you pass them on. We now know that, you know, there's a sort of an intergenerational legacy. Slavery's shown us that. The stolen generations are still teaching us that. And there's this fear if you're the child of a violent person, as you know, many children of alcoholics have the same fear. You know, maybe I've got it too.
Yeah, you have this great empathy for characters who, from a distance, would just appear very unattractive, ugly people. They're, you know, often, in this case, he's a bully. You wouldn't want to be his schoolmate at school or his teacher.
Wouldn't even want to be in the street with Jaxie. You'd cross the street to avoid him. You wouldn't have him in your house. You wouldn't give him a lift. He's a dirty, scary, you know, threatening kind of boy. You know, you just think, oh, you know, step aside, you know, just go away.
Where do you get the empathy for that character?
Oh, I mean, I just am interested in those people. I mean, I guess I'm less interested in the attractive people. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's got a secret. Everyone's valuable. And, it sort of upsets me, particularly with boys who are non-compliant or who make mistakes or who simply follow the scripts that have been written for them. They're the boys who get kicked out of class. They're the boys who end up in the justice system. They're the boys who end up filling our detention centres and jails. And, you know, a lot of them have done terrible things, but a lot of them have just, you know, their destiny's almost been written for them by their culture and their family. What chance did they have? They're living in the only world that they know. They're repeating the patterns that have been laid down before them. And sometimes we punish them for their faithful adherence to the script. Yeah. And, I just think we avert our gaze from them. You know, I mean, you shouldn't have to see a kid in a restraint chair in a spit hood to feel some first twinkle of curiosity or empathy.
Your characters have some existential moments out in the wilderness. They're the loneliness and the awesomeness of it. I mean, this is reflecting, presumably, at least to some degree, your experience there.
Oh, yeah, I think really, if you took the natural world away from us, our ability to believe in or yearn for or want to join with the divine would be diminished. I think once the natural world's gone, humans are going to struggle as they've never struggled before to cope with ideas of God, because you know, the first form of revelation is the natural world.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember who it was now, who was a famous writer who used to say every day you need to get out in some form or other into the natural world, and not just for exercise. It's just to experience it. It might be a cold, it might be uncomfortable, but you have to do that in order to kind of almost maintain your humanity.
Yeah, you're diminished as a human if you're not engaging somehow with the natural world, because if you're not engaging with creation, you're not engaging with the divine. You've rolled the shutters down. And this idea that you can somehow, you know, maintain some kind of engagement or relationship with the divine through abstract thought only. You know, you sit in your room and adhere to orthodox thinking. That dog just doesn't hunt.
I often think this when people are on the treadmill in the gym, where they could run easily into the parks, and you know, it's just. But I don't understand it.
You don't get TV in the parks.
No.
You don't get a magazine rack on your
you need that constant connection. How important is forgiveness in this story? Even characters being able to forgive themselves. Is it forgiveness or something else? I feel like there's some sort of resolution they're hungry for.
Yeah, I think they want to understand more. I think there's that. Jaxie wants to be better than he is. I mean, he's got no, in his background, there's no education to, or he's never had any reinforcement to reach for something better. He's in this practical, pragmatic, utilitarian world of, you know, whatever you can grasp with your hands or beat with your hands. He wants to be better than his dad. He thinks there's something that, he's been told all his life that he's rubbish, but he yearns. I mean, the word decency comes up a bit, and it's the only word that he can sort of. He talked about peace and decency. He doesn't have a language for all these other other aspirations of, you know, tenderness and compassion and kindness, and even forgiveness is a bit of a hard one for him. But I think he wants to be better, and he wants to make things better for Lee, his girlfriend. And but also I think he's schooled by the world that he's in. I mean, that's hard schooling, because you know, living out on the edge of the Salt Lakes, on the edge of the desert, with a rifle and a box of bullets is not a not a pretty business. But he's yearning for something better, and Fintan, on the other hand, is, I think he wants forgiveness, and he needs to forgive himself, and he wants some sense of expiation. You know, he wants and there's not much available out there in exile on your own, and he's supposed to be working out his. He's supposed to be working out, you know, the his spiritual accounting in on the edge of the desert with.
And interestingly, with no one else. You can't do that on your own either.
No.
There's a community sort of element to that. The story contains elements that are not foreign to your work, certainly in recent times anyway, that involve sacrifice in order to achieve some form of redemption. These are old-fashioned concepts in a lot of ways that you're appealing to.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think in the end, Jaxie knows that, you know, well, by the end of the book, there's some very muddled sense in Jaxie that in order to achieve peace, you need to lay down your weapons. not sure if he actually does that. But I think he sees that there's someone in the world, not someone that you'd really expect, but there's someone in the world who will go to the war for him. And in a sense, you know, can't say too much without spoiling the book, but, you know, Fintan pretty much shows him what a human can do for another person when there's no benefit to them. And Fintan doesn't really do it for himself. I don't think he does it so that he can achieve some sense of redemption. He does it out of love. He does it because he wants the boy to have peace. He wants the boy to have a life. He's sort of in awe of this child as some sort of embodiment of vigorous, feral, foul youth, you know. And he just sees him as suddenly he's all the children of the world. And if he can save one child, he's saved the world in a sense. And yeah, that does involve a pretty pretty rugged sacrifice. And in a sense, Jaxie's scorched by that. He's taught by that, but he's scorched by it because it's quite a terrible thing for him to see, and he's also implicated in it as well.
I was reading an article on Flannery O'Connor that writes that the upended moment, the breaking in or breaking through of a vagrant, unbiddable reality, this is the grace of God and the sign of his love. I thought that was kind of a nice description of that writing, but also would fit yours too.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of comes at a different angle from the epigraph of the book, which is from an American poet called Liam Rector, and the line is, change is hard and hope is violent. And those lines troubled me for years. And they continued to trouble me because Liam was a friend of mine, and he took his own life. But just this idea that how difficult it is to change as a person, as a society, as a family. But the actual—I think I was hung up on the word violent. You know, that hope is violent, and it is violent. But I'm not talking about physical violence. And, you know, hope deranges us. Hope breaks things down and in order to change, things must be broken. And there is that thing, you know, the moment where your consciousness breaks and something else pushes through. You know, I think we can often get very romantic and soppy about the language that we use about it, or even the ways that we imagine that. When your life changes, when you fall in love, when you have a spiritual revelation, when you realise that the way that you've been living or the way that you've been acting toward people who are close to you is appalling, you know, that's a violent moment. And I think we need to reserve a little bit of respect for the word violent.
Yeah, well, you really do. There's this sense of destructiveness in order to... It's sort of breaking people down in order to restore them. And I think people, maybe that's one of the reasons people really connect with what you're doing, because there's a sense we get this, that people understand this, even though it's hard. The sort of, you know, I also read that Flannery O'Connor said of her fiction that it was the action of grace in territory largely held by the devil. I thought it was a nice quote.
No, she's bang on the money there, and she was, you know, she was the best at it. And also, you know, in Flannery O'Connor's work, the people who are often the bearers of grace are the most dishevelled, the smelliest.
The least likely.
Yeah, and they're always going to have the worst teeth. So, you know, I've got that in common with her. So. No, I just think that you got to go looking beyond the conventional, you know. You can't go looking for people in cardigans to carry all your water for you, you know, in terms of, you know, this kind of stuff. It's down and dirty. And look, you know, there's a long tradition of that in our tradition. You know, Christ didn't really cast the net very far up the social spectrum when he looked for his mates.
No, it's the whole Christian story in a way, Old Testament and New. The least likely, the least attractive, the least able are the ones that become the sort of heroes of the story over and over.
And, you know, they didn't really even come good. Basically, they were pretty rubbish.
Yeah, which many of us take great comfort from. Is it pushing it a bit to say that Fintan in this story is at various points a Christ figure? And if he is there a function? What's that function that he plays?
I'm always uncomfortable when people talk about Christ figures in books. But I think he's a person who, having pretty much traduced all his beliefs, a person who's kind of trodden on all that was sacred to him, he's trying to recover some sense of self-respect, some sense of worth, that his life wasn't utterly wasted in this great, grand sort of hypocritical sludge fest, which, you know, many people can get to, you know, especially if they're sort of professional Christians, you know. So, you know, in the end, he's reaching for something, and he's sort of stepping up with all the last shreds of what's left of him, and if that makes him a, you know, but I just think it's just another human impulse to give, you know. People are going to see that you know, he's a Christ figure, because he gets, you know. Oh, I don't want to go into the details,
but there's perhaps just
there's an echo hint of that. There's no question of, you know, this is a guy who's been a priest all his life. He's spouted all this stuff. He would have stood up in front of crucifixes all his life, especially as an Irish Catholic. And it's almost as though it's only just at the last moment become real to him, or he's been able to make it real to himself, or that he, by his actions, is an agent of grace, not just for the boy, but for himself. And I guess that, you know, it does echo something that it says earlier in the book, that, when the kid asks him, you know, so, you know, you're an ex-priest, you know, you still believe in God, and the priest goes, well, I'm really not sure anymore. And then he corrects himself later and says, well, it's not really a matter of what you believe, it's what you do, and what you do ends up being what you believe.
Yeah.
And in the end, he, despite all his bollocks, he's full of bulldust, you know, but he lives that out. He steps up, and in the end, it's the grace is in the act.
The Shepherd's Hut, a new novel by Tim Winton, is very timely. It addresses a kind of masculinity that's limiting for men and, frankly, dangerous for women.
Yeah, it's sort of accidental in its timeliness. I certainly didn't write a book into this cultural moment. You just can't, because they take too long. And I wouldn't anyway, because I'm too scared. But Yeah, look, I'm interested in the way that men are blind to how rotten patriarchy and misogyny is for them as well. You know, because it distorts their lives, it narrows them, and we see that right from childhood. You watch these lovely, tender, vulnerable, graceful boys having all those lovely qualities, which are natural qualities in boys as much as in girls, having it shamed or beaten out of them so that they cleave to one very narrow view of masculinity, which is, you know,
domineering,
narrow, silent, angry, and taking, never giving, but you don't realise that, you know, that just, it impoverishes kids, it impoverishes boys, it impoverishes their manhood, and it impoverishes everybody and endangers everybody else around them. And it's not necessary, you know. And look, I think the church has, you know, quite a bit to answer for in this regard. You know, we're great, over the centuries, great supporters of patriarchy, and it's always men who've benefited, and I think it's great that women have made such strides in the last couple of generations, but they're motivated to progress because there's something to get, and they see that there's something to get, and even if it's, you know, if you're going to try and get equity and you're going to get justice and you're going to get some sort of equality of power, you reach for that, but you're motivated to do that. Where we're stuck is the other side of the equation, and where the real progress could be made from here is men changing. But you have to, there's a difference of motivation, because to change and progress, men need to not reach out so much as to let go and relent and to examine themselves and to become conscious of, you know, all their unexamined privilege, the ways in which they project violence and control when they're not even conscious of it, and realise how the other half lives and has always lived. And until men are prepared to examine themselves and climb down off their roosts, then I think, you know, the prospects for all of us aren't so good. You know, women can only fight so hard and so far, and it's great that they are, that you move forward, you plant your flag, you defend your position, you send a few brave people out to ahead, and you gain a little bit more ground. It just doesn't need to be like that. If men could own up, wise up, and be decent.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. Tim Winton's novel, The Shepherd's Hut, is available now. Get yourself a copy, it's great. Tim's been on our show before to talk about his other work. You can find these interviews at our website, publicchristianity.org. For more conversations on life and faith, please subscribe to our podcast. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. We'll be taking a break for a couple of weeks, but we'll be back with conversations from our documentary, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined.
I first went to Russia after the wall fell, and the thing was that they'd been left in ignorance about Christianity. I remember one man who said to me, when I asked him, "Do you ever talk about God?" And his answer was, "Well, tell me about England. Do you talk about green cows?" And I said, "No, we don't actually." Well, he said, "Why not?" Well, I said, "Because green cows don't exist." He said, "Precisely." And when you started to say there was evidence for belief in God, that just staggered them. Evidence? There isn't any evidence. There can't be any evidence. So the idea that Christianity might have some kind of intellectual underpinning was totally new.